I spend a lot of time with race plans, and I spend a lot of time getting people's heads right around execution and not expectation. Make the goal about having a celebrating the day and managing the day the best they can. You got to really give them the tools to execute. And I think that's what I do best, is I really give people a lot of confidence, but I also let them know that if stuff starts to go sideways, here's what I want you to think about. Forget about the end. Think about your nutrition. Think about your cadence. Think about your pacing, your breathing, the stuff that really helps you get through things rather than you're focusing on that end game.
My next question for you was going to be about the benefits of hiring a coach versus being self-coached. And I think you just answered that, quite honestly. Hi, everyone. This is The Podium, and I'm Dr. Kevin Sprouse. Our podcast originated as a resource for my practice, where I work with professional athletes and high-performing individuals from around the world. Today, it has become a forum for an even greater audience, and we welcome everyone as we discuss the principles of performance and then disseminate pertinent, actionable information with our patients in mind. One thing to note before we begin, the content of this podcast is not meant as medical advice. This is for general informational purposes only. Welcome to The Podium. Welcome to another episode of The Podium. I'm Dr. Kevin Sprouse. Today, we dig into principles of training. And the reason we're doing this is a little bit time specific. It's the beginning of the year, but it's the end of January. So at least when we're recording this, it'll come out a little bit after that. But this is that time of year, at least in my mind, where all the New Year's resolutions that we're going to flame out quickly have done that. And the people that are left really looking at the upcoming year are probably not looking at exercise programs per se, but they're looking at training programs. They have a goal that they want to reach, whether that's a given race, a 5K, a half marathon, an Ironman, an ultra endurance bike race. There's all kinds of things out there. The principles of training that get you to a successful completion of that goal, those principles are really conserved or maintained across different distances and disciplines. You have to tweak them a bit differently, but we're going to get into that conversation today on how you set yourself up to accomplish those goals and what are those principles of training. When I thought about who I wanted to have this conversation with, the very first person that jumped to mind was Robbie Ventura. And Robbie is a former professional cyclist who's been a professional coach for years now. His business, his coaching practice is Vision Quest, and that is out of Chicago, but he works with athletes all over the country. And Robbie is an amazing wealth of knowledge on training and the physiology and the coaching that's necessary to get someone to their goal. But he's also an amazing motivator, and being able to combine those two talents, those two knowledge bases, is just hugely powerful. And I've seen that in the clients that he works with. Robbie is one of my favorite people in endurance sport. And if I'm honest, he's just one of my favorite people. And I think if you sit and listen to this, you'll understand why. Just an amazing person, great wealth of knowledge, truly passionate about what he does. Again, Vision Quest Coaching is his practice. He's also helped develop a cycling platform, training platform, coaching platform called Velocity that I highly recommend you check out. But first and foremost, sit back, enjoy this conversation with Robbie Ventura. Well, Robbie, thank you for coming on the podcast. This is one that I'm just thrilled to have you on here. One of the greatest folks in endurance sport, a good friend of mine, Robbie Ventura. Thanks, man.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here as well. I mean, you know how I feel about Doc Sprouse. I mean, he is my my Buddha, and I'm just excited to be on the show, honored to be on the show, and fired up to talk about training.
Well, thank you. And this is one that I love to have you on here, and can't wait to pick your brain, your expertise on this, because it's a topic that I think at first glance seems kind of basic, but it's one that it can get screwed up for people really quickly if they don't do the right things. And we're talking about the principles of training, specifically principles of training for endurance. We're going to talk through a cycling lens because even though you've coached people in triathlon and marathon and all kinds of things, you've got a really rich history in cycling. And so we're going to talk that way. But if you're not a cyclist and you're listening to this, there's the foundations of it still apply. Tell us a little bit about you, how you got into sport, your own personal athletic journey.
For sure. And it kind of ties in with what you just talked about. Like, I think ultimately, my athletic journey, I was a stick and ball athlete. I was a baseball player and a hockey player, first and foremost. Those are the sports that I grew up doing. I was just a regular Midwestern kid from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Had a dad that just loved sports, that really exposed me to a lot of different sports. My mom didn't let me play football. I would have loved to have played football, but it's probably my favorite sport to watch. I love my Packers. Unfortunately, we took one on the chin last week. But I was a stick and ball athlete that was, I think I had maybe a little bit above average ability, eye-hand coordination and explosiveness. And we have a velodrome in Kenosha, and my dad was a bicycle racer as well. So he exposed me to the track, and I was a good track racer. I went to the World Championships in 1993 in Hamar, Norway. I got fifth in the elimination on the track. And I was an okay endurance athlete. I really was just an okay endurance athlete. I was much better with my explosiveness and my coordination and my ability to handle the bicycle and all those skills that I took from my other sports I brought to cycling. And I needed to take those skills to cycling because I didn't have the massive VO2 max. I didn't have the unbelievable aerobic engine that the guys I was racing against. So I got into this to coaching. I got into to performance because to keep up with those really good guys, I had to do everything right. I had to experiment. I had to figure things out before everybody else did. I was totally into power-based training and reading everything I possibly could because I needed all of those little marginal gains to be able to keep up with the good guys. And still, when it got too hard or too epic, like the Tour de France, I couldn't do stuff like that. I never did the Tour de France because you can only take your performance so far legally, right? Like there's only so many things that you can do on the training side to optimize. And it's probably the reason why I feel like I went into coaching because I just think that there's a lot more that people have inside them than they realize. And I was able to get as close as I possibly could. And I needed to compete at the level that I wanted. So,
which was a really high level. I mean, you talk about being pretty good, but you were on teams that did the Tour de France. You were not selected for the, you know, 8 or 9 man roster, whatever it was at the time. But you were on the 30 man roster that did a lot of the, you know, what is now World Tour. So, I think that's important to mention because what you're saying is entirely true. You can have genetics that are pretty good with respect to endurance, but if you train really well, intentionally, you know, tick the right boxes, you can compete above your God-given talent level, if that makes sense.
For sure. Like I always say, all the people in Vision Quest, I want you to punch above your weight class. Yeah. I want you to be better than your genetic makeup is. And to me, if we can do that, we've done a good job. You know, we've optimized. And those are for the people that want to go up there, right? We have a lot of people that we work with that don't want to necessarily optimize and maximize everything because of the cost of everything else in their life, right? So I think it's important to realize that, you know, I wanted to go as far as I possibly could. So I took every opportunity I possibly could. And that was my number one goal. For most people that we work with now, you know, finishing Dirty Cans in the top 10% of their age group is not their life's goal. It's one thing that they'd love to do, but ultimately, you know, they have other things that take priority, like their family. So I think
maybe they just want to finish it at all, which
right,
is
exactly.
I mean, totally. 200-mile race. That's huge.
Absolutely. So, it's a brief history. I played college hockey. I just love that sport. If I could have played professional hockey, I probably would have, but I just wasn't good enough. And, you know, after I started, you know, slowing down my cycling, I started coaching a lot more. I took on a lot of athletes while I was still a professional athlete. I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I understood that my career was going to end soon. And I really wanted to, and I started having kids and I started growing a family and had a great wife. So I really wanted to find a place where I could make money and enjoy what I'm doing. And of course I picked coaching, which was great. It's been such an awesome journey for me. And honestly, as a professional cyclist, there is this selfishness that's part of your life that you have to be to some degree. And I felt like once I started coaching athletes and watching others succeed, it really brought another part of my personality that I feel like I've been missing in a big way. And I'm very, very blessed to have found it. And ultimately it's become my happiness, right? I just love watching people achieve their goals, grow, improve, strengthen relationships, and all the great things that happen with endurance sports.
Well, in your business, your coaching practice called Vision Quest, you've done what I think is a fantastic job of working with very high level athletes, as well as those, everyday Joes like me, to get the most out of them through both a really scientific approach, and a very motivational approach. I think anybody who's listened this far can recognize that you've got a passion for this. It really drives you to connect with your clients and push them further. But what it's also driven you to, that I've realized through the years, is a real understanding of the science behind training, as well as an understanding of the application of that science. And those are two very different things. I mean, we see people who have a mastery of physiology who could not coach Matthew Vanderpool to a win, right? Like, this is a guy that is just, he's going to win everything, but they don't have any practical application, and vice versa. You see people who are hugely motivating and sometimes have success, and you hear what they're saying, you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. They're just motivating these people. And you've got a really sweet spot, I think, of understanding both sides of this. And that's why when we wanted to do an episode on this topic, I really wanted to pick your brain on it. So if we start to look at the basic principles of training, so if you and I were talking to somebody who, has some fitness, but has been kind of, maybe through the holidays has been a little sedentary, or for the past year or so, they haven't had a goal. So they've been active, but not training. And they really want to move forward. Where do you start with that person?
Yeah, I think as you kind of go through this process of coaching, and like you talked about, learning the science and understanding the practical application and working with thousands of athletes and making a bunch of mistakes and experimenting with a bunch of different things, that's how you really kind of come full circle and are able to optimize each and every athlete that comes to you. Because I think it's tough to know what to do with everybody unless you've had an experience with someone very much like that, with similar goal, similar physiology, whatever. So I think that comes with time. I've been doing this for so long, Doc. Since 1990, I've been 25 years a coach, and thousands and thousands of athletes in all different ability levels. So I've learned a lot from the athletes, is my point. Like, yeah. A lot of coaches fresh off kind of growing their business, only have one experience, their own, right? How training has affected them. So it's one of the biggest mistakes all coaches make early on, is they apply how they've responded to how other people are going to respond. And it just doesn't work that way. And it takes a lot of other responses to really start to understand and put people in different categories and build your toolbox. So, but the basic training principle that I would tell this person is one of the most important things is figure out what these people's motivations are. Where are they coming from? What's a little bit of their history and what this journey really means to them? Is it really about, we have had so many people come to us that were addicted to alcohol or drugs. Mm-hmm. And this journey is more about switching their addiction to cycling, right? Or to endurance sports, which is a much healthier switch. So understanding an athlete's motivations to me is such an important part of the process. Do they just want to be well? Are they using cycling or an endurance event to help their wellness overall? Or are they really well? They just want to push themselves and do a Misogi for that matter, right? Like do something way outside of their box and see if they can survive it. Like, motivation to me and why they're doing what they're doing is probably the most important piece to start the process or the puzzle. Once you understand their motivation, how you manage and handle that athlete, I think really changes quite a bit. So I know that's not a training principle, but I think that's important to note, is the athlete's motivation.
Oh, I think it's hugely important, and it informs the goal. And so you have to know what the goal is of training, right? Because if you don't know where you're going, you don't really know how to get there. But that goal doesn't have to be a race or an event. You know, it could be, like you said, that in a year or 2 years' time, you want to be X percent better than you are now. And that's quantifiable. But without knowing the motivation for getting there, you can't help them down that path. And sometimes you need to redirect and say, okay, I understand you've set this goal because of this motivation, but this goal is either maybe it's too big, maybe it's too small, maybe it's just not really in keeping with what you're trying to do, and this would be a better one. So without understanding that motivation component, I agree. You're kind of, if you set off down looking at, you know, duration, intensity, frequency, how we're going to prescribe these things, periodization, and you don't know what motivates them or why they're doing this, it's going to be one of those, you know, 3 week January, New Year's resolution type things just fall apart.
Yeah. And this kind of goes to my whole theory around coaching is a big part of it is connection with the athlete, right? And if you know their motivation, it's so much easier to connect with them. It's so much easier to pull the right levers and to because at the end of the day, training is just about like the things you just talked about, frequency, intensity, right? Volume is part of that, frequency and intensity, like the mixture of both, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the other elements of the circle, right? Nutrition, strength and training and keeping the athlete healthy, the psychology part of it. There's a lot of things that go into it. But if you know their motivation and you can connect with the athlete, A, you can build trust right away, right? Because you understand you're with them on this journey and you know the reasons why they're on this journey. And that just in itself is super important. Now, I think it's kind of crazy where I've been a complete binary coach for a lot of my life, right? I'm really focused on the numbers. I do a series of tests to start everything off. I understand what their metabolic profile is. I know exactly how much time they have available to train. That part of it is really important. But what's more important than that is the relationship that you have with that athlete, the relationship that athlete has with other people in their lives. And I think what I really try to focus on, and you talked about the goal being super important, I de-emphasize the goal a little bit and emphasize the journey and the process a lot more, because I always think the goal is the celebration of the journey. And although the goal kind of keeps us on the fairway at times and is something that's standing out there, even for the best racers in the world, even the Tour de France, like even the highest level, if they really dial in the journey and find it meaningful, they find it exciting, they find it motivating, they find a connection there, the race is a lot, hell of a lot easier and a hell of a lot more fun. And it's more of how can we improve the execution on race day? Not, I did all this for this event, right? Really, it's getting them used to and getting them excited about growth, getting better, improving. And when people start to grow, they're happier. Let me tell you, like improvement, in my opinion, is one of the best ways to find happiness, to feel like you're improving. It doesn't have to always be physical. You can just be learning more. You can just be improving your ability to listen to somebody. Like getting better at stuff is the whole reason I coach. It's the whole reason why you're a doctor, is because we can make people feel better, get better. And no matter what age they are, that's a powerful drug. And it's something that will be good for everybody. It'll be good for our relationship. It'll be good for them in the future. And ultimately, growth and journey is what I really try to focus the training principles on. All that other stuff matters, Doc. Don't get me wrong. Like we want people to, like you need to do all those things right. You need to do the right intensity. You need to have the right volume. You need to make sure their balance of life is good, because that's what's going to make the journey meaningful. And the goal will just happen.
Yeah.
Maybe too much.
No, not too much. I mean, that's so important, because I think people can get lost in the black and white aspect of training and not pay attention to that stuff, which is really more important in you know the patient or the client's life in general. But it's more important toward the performance too, because like you said, I mean, I've had numerous athletes that I've worked with through the years who have a goal set. I mean, famously this past year, we put on the EF team, we put a lot of time and resource, and admittedly probably pressure, onto Richard Carapaz for the Tour de France. And he crashed out the first day. Nobody's fault, right? But that's cycling. But if the athlete comes to that position and that is the be all end all and something out of the control takes them out of it, you can't control weather. You can't control mechanicals. You can't control how well someone else is prepared, right? I mean, you may come against somebody who's just flying and there's nothing you can do. And if you've put all your eggs in that basket of competing on that day, it's going to be more often than not disappointing. But if instead you've peaked and you gave it your best effort and it didn't work, but you can say, okay, you know what? There's another race in 3 weeks. I'm really fit. I'm going to go do that one. Then it can be just a lot of fun. It becomes a challenge, not something to be overcome, but something to just kind of test yourself. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a bit softer than some of the stuff that, that a lot of people think about when constructing a training plan, but I believe it's remarkably more important and foundational, because unless you do that, as you start to put all the blocks together in your training plan, you really haven't set it off on a path toward likely success.
Yep. And you kind of get there. I think you start off with, I got to do everything just right. I got to make sure I'm building up their plan by 5% there's all these theories around increasing training volume and 80-20 or pyramidal or polarized training approach or the Norwegian method and all these things that are out there, right? Understanding and knowing all that stuff is super important as a coach, right?
Yeah.
And having a couple of default mechanisms in place where I have a default mechanism is I pull intensity down. I'm really nervous about how much intensity I give athletes. And my default is always under intensity and always over aerobic. And you're going to make less mistakes. You're going to have fewer burnouts and flameouts, right? And slowly increase training volume, right? These are just basic training principles that I kind of go by. I believe that, you know, in the beginning of any relationship, it's important to understand what their aerobic heart rate and power outputs are and to teach them those heart rates and to monitor power while they maintain the heart rate. So
most people will overshoot that just by nature.
For sure.
You give them a prescription to go do 2 hours aerobic and they're probably doing 2 hours, you know, bumping around the lower end of threshold of LT1. And we don't have to get into all that, but like that point where it's considerably above aerobic, but you know, maintainable. And so I think your point's a good one, really understanding the science and being able to give them that targeted prescription, doesn't mean that you're getting too far in the weeds of like black and white and testing and all that stuff for someone who's even recreational. It's a really important metric to know. It goes hand in hand with the other softer stuff we were talking about too.
And teaching them. So I think some of the issues that I see people make mistakes is if they don't have a coach or they do have a coach and the coach tells them to go do a certain intensity, they may do it or they may go higher than that intensity because they feel good because they don't know, right? Yeah. But once you actually test their 2 millimolar, you show them where their fat and carbohydrate is the same and you show them on paper and test them in a lab and say, this is where you're optimizing aerobic stress. Then they go, oh, okay. So education is part of the coaching process. So one of my training principles is everybody knows why they're doing everything they're doing because they'll do it more, right? They won't come out around as much. They may still chase somebody down on Zwift because they have egos like we all do. But for the most part, if they understand why they need to be in a certain spot, they want to do it significantly more. So I think education is important and knowing where that aerobic number is, but also getting them excited about, hey, my aerobic heart rate is 135-ish, 135, 140. I'm staying inside of this heart rate. And guess what? I average 160 watts. A month later, I'm average 172 at that same heart rate. Aerobically, I'm getting better. Once they start to believe and see the growth, boom, they pay attention. They're in the pocket. They know what they're doing. So
yeah,
I think education is part of getting people to do it.
I agree entirely. So let's do a bit of a hypothetical. Say I'm coming to you as a new client. And I tell you, hey, this isn't a stretch. I used to be pretty fit. Now I'm fine. Like I'm healthy, active, you know, fitter than most, but for a competitive point of view, I have no edge, right? I've got maybe 6 or 8 hours a week to work with.
Good.
And we can play with those things we talked about, duration, intensity, and frequency. Where do we start? How do we kind of ease into this? And let's say I want to do, I don't know, steamboat gravel. We're looking out at September. We've got 8-9 months to do this.
Sure.
Yeah. How do we start down this road?
So I know your history, right? You were a great endurance athlete. So the base is already in place, right? You know how to suffer because you've already been, you know, a cyclist before.
Because I've ridden on your wheel.
Yeah, right. You have 6 to 8 hours now. Do you have potentially 8 to 10 hours at some point so we can get that volume up a little bit? Because that SBT event, if you're doing the Black Horse, which I know you want to do because you want something challenging, which is 140 miles, it's going to be a long event, right? It's going to be a long event. So the two main energies.
So it bounces around. I've got probably 8 to 10 hours on weeks when I'm home. And then traveling, I've got 6 to 8, and also fewer resources in terms of a, you know, no bike on the road.
Gotcha. Any opportunity to do something where you can go somewhere warm with your family and get a few long days in a row, like a mini little training camp. Those always help, right? Build that aerobic base that you're going to need. That's going to get you through this big event. Any of those on the diet, a possibility?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
And even something that I would love doing, you know, it's we've got spring break coming up. In whatever, 6 or 8 weeks, we'll be down in Florida for, I'll actually be there for 2 weeks, with some work tacked on there. So that'd be a great time.
Great. So that, the first thing I want to understand is that you can actually do the event, right? And it sounds like because of your history, because you have some big blocks, because you can extend your training a little bit, I think it's a stretch, but I don't think you're going to necessarily potentially try to win the race, but I think getting through the race and enjoying the race itself, you can absolutely do that with your history and what you have going. But the first thing we want to do is we want to do some sort of metabolic assessment, right? I want to get an idea. I'd also like to do a body comp assessment. You know, when you go up those hills and you're riding at altitude, weight and optimizing your body composition is important. And out of those 8 hours, does that include the strength training or is that just you have 8 hours of cycling and you're going to do strength training on top of that? Just again, a few more questions because we're going to do this.
Fair enough. Right now that includes the strength training. I usually do that around lunchtime or early afternoon and 1 hour right now it's 1 hour, 2 or 3 days a week.
Got it. So I'm just going to assume you're strong. I'm going to assume you have a good base and you're athletic and there's no injuries. I'm going to take a bunch of assumptions here just so I can get to the meat and potatoes of the cycling. But if you did a DEXA scan and we saw that you had good muscle mass and we saw that you had different things, we might make some suggestions to keep or maybe even grow that muscle mass depending on where it lines up. But I'm guessing, you know, I know you pretty well, Doc. You're strong, you're very, very athletic and you're healthy, which is great. We're going to say that we don't have any health issues and or any challenges that way. We're just going to focus on the cycling piece for now. One of the first things we want to find out is that establish that aerobic output, right? What is the aerobic output? And to be honest, you know, and this is something I feel strongly about. And there's a lot of literature out there that kind of maybe doesn't necessarily agree with me. I think that stress, the total stress is important. And if you only have a few hours to train, riding all of it in zone two, to me, is not optimal. If you have a lot of time to train, you have to train down in that zone two because the cost of training harder doesn't allow you to keep growing, right? You can't recover from the work. But if you have a very small amount of time to train, I don't believe the bulk of the time should be in zone two, personally. You can argue with that. You can have your own feelings on it. But there's not enough stress on the VO2 max system at that low intensity if you're not a very highly trained endurance athlete to actually get enough stress to grow. I don't think the stress response is enough. So in your case, you have 8 hours. We can spend some time in zone two because that's a lot of time. I mean, it's maybe not a lot of time for Pogacar, but it's a lot of time for you and I, 8 hours. Mm-hmm. So I think we would probably spend at least 2 or 3 rides just building that base in that zone two. And what I like to do is as you get more fit, maybe we spend 60 minutes in zone two and the last 20 minutes in zone three, just to start to increase the stress on the VO2 max system and to add training volume that way. I like to start with the zone two and then finish maybe with a little tempo. And then one day a week, we might actually do some higher intensity training just to start opening up the size of the motor, just opening up the high end. And based on your test, right, your threshold may be, you know, 75 or 90% of your VO2 max. If that's the case, we got to push that VO2 max up a little bit. We got to get that high end power. But yeah, if your threshold is really far away from your high end, we may spend more of that intensity at threshold. So it really, the type of intensity we're going to do is going to be based around where your overall metabolic curve looks like. Is it slanted on really, really high aerobic and threshold and the VO2 max is low, therefore we have to push that up? Or are you this incredible explosive athlete with this high VO2 max that really doesn't need to get that any higher? We really need to push the threshold a little bit closer to that VO2 max. I don't know if everybody is listening is going to understand this, but basically everybody's threshold is a certain percentage of their VO2 max. And depending on how close that is, determines what the intensity we do. If it's far away, we work the threshold. If it's real close, we work the VO2 max a little bit. And this is before we get into the specificity of the event itself. We're just building the motor per se and trying to optimize the time that we're training. So
I haven't done any testing recently, but I can guarantee you that I fall into that former category where my threshold is probably fine. I mean, it could use some nudging, but really my VO2 max and my VO2 max estimated is probably around 55, 58, which is okay. But I've got no glycolytic capacity because I haven't done anything high intensity. So for sure in these efforts, you're going to be pushing me to do intensity. And the point you're making is that if you were to draw out my physiologic curve, my threshold probably bumps up against my VO2 max pretty quickly. So as soon as I go over threshold, as soon as I pass that lactate threshold, start really huffing and puffing, I come to failure very quickly. I've got no margin there to do anything that's high intensity. And that's where we need to work on.
Yeah. So that's what I would do. I would say, okay, that's pretty obvious that's how you're built or that's where you're at currently right now. That's going to change, right?
Yeah.
Because I think you're going to respond fairly quickly to those high-end intervals, but they take a lot out of us, right? There's a cost to that type of work, probably a higher cost than threshold-based work. So one of the goals would be to give you some of that work, see how you respond, and then give you a lot of that aerobic condition as well, and to slowly increase the amount of aerobic condition as you increase the power at aerobic, because you're going to get more fit, and keep a close eye on how you manage those 3 and 4 minute intervals. And give you a couple of different types of the VO2 work to see kind of how you respond best. Maybe give you some 40 over 20s, maybe give you some 4 minute efforts. But either way, we want to get that heart rate up. We want to start exploring and pushing and growing that high end a little bit. And ultimately start the process with just tuning and building the engine. And as you start to evolve and as you start to, you know, I think monitoring is obviously a huge training principle that we didn't talk about early, is literally monitoring how you're growing, both from a standpoint of power output, as well as, you know, recovery, how you're recovering from these different intervals, how you're feeling. And the key to this all, and what makes the human component really important, is how you like what your comments are, how you're feeling during these workouts, how you're responding, and what you're telling me is going on. Because that'll let me know as much as this stuff, honestly, Doc, is if you're positive and you're happy and you're liking the work and it's all working out, we can keep increasing things, right? But as soon as you start saying, this didn't feel good, I don't like this, I'm not feeling great, and it's probably going to coincide with what we're looking at on the recovery metrics, I take as much stock into what you tell me as I do anything else that I look at. Like how you're viewing the work is all part of that. Am I enjoying the journey? Am I growing? Am I learning? Am I feeling better? And that comes out.
It's also scientifically validated. I mean, there are papers that look at comparing subjective metrics of recovery to the objective ones. And really, it's 50-50. I mean, they both carry just as much weight. And so what you're saying is is right in line with the research out there. And as I get older and older, if we had taken this hypothetical journey 15 years ago, you would have had to give me much less recovery. Like we could just push. Right now, I mean, look at the gray in this beard, right? I'm
getting old. Still looking good, man.
Thank you. But I know that about myself, and it's very normal. I mean, it's expected that as you get older, you do these bigger efforts, whether they're really long or really intense. And I'm going to need probably a couple days to recover. And that doesn't mean on my butt, but that may mean the next day is either active recovery, active rest, so to speak, or even just another one of those aerobic rides at, you know, if 135, 140 is my heart rate, maybe we drop it down to 120 and just kind of spin a bit, get a little bit of stimulus, but recover. And knowing that about somebody, looking at their comments, and when you're talking comments, you guys use Training Peaks, right? To follow your athletes. Yep. So it's really important to do that upfront testing of some sort. I mean, you've got the whole metabolic facility, which is amazing. And I highly recommend for anybody who has a nearby resource to do that. It is the way to go. But there's some field tests and things that can be done too. You get those benchmark tests, but then, you know, every week or every day, looking at kind of how you're feeling, how you're progressing, getting micro checks along the way, and then stepping back and say, okay, maybe you and I have been working together for 4 months, 5 months. I bet you're going to want to have me back in the lab.
Absolutely. And just to take a step back,
yeah.
And I do this on my velocity classes, every single class is what I like athletes to do. And Doc, this is what I'd have you do on your hard days. You'd warm up, and then I'd want you to find a little hill, the same area, the same hill that you have outside of your house, whatever. And I would like you to go up that hill at threshold, but don't look at your power. And maybe it's a 3 or 4 minute effort. And then when you get to the top, look down at your power meter. You're going to start to really understand if you're fresh or if you're tired, if you're growing, if you're tired. Like, you need to create some checks and balances in your training that you know what something feels like, and you don't look at your output, and then you look at it. And if it's really high that day, you're rocking and rolling, you can open the throttle. If it's really low, you might have to pump the brakes at least for the next 30 minutes and try it again. Like, I think starting to figure out where perceived exertion is versus what you're doing, teaching the athlete that is so valuable, because then they can make critical decisions on hard days. Doc, if I give you a 4 minute day and you start rolling out, and you kind of do your threshold and you look down and you're at 80% of your FTP and you thought you were at 100, you better proceed with caution. And if you start to see that on a consistent basis, we got to change things up, because I'll tell you, as a coach, we all make a ton of mistakes, but the really good coaches catch them quickly, right? And they really work with the athlete to not flail too long, is what I say. But
I think that's a great point. It's something I see, and this makes me feel old putting it this way, but with younger athletes who have grown up with all these metrics, far too often, you know, I can ask them, hey, how was training today? And they recite a list of, you know, normalized power was this, I did this many kilojoules, I did. And it's like, no, just how'd it feel? That's all I'm asking, you know? And there's a lot of a disconnect there, even with recreational athletes, where they just don't know how something should feel and when that's off, right? So it's not just about knowing how it should feel, but once you know that and you go out to replicate that, and you're like, whoa, it feels hard today. Or it feels great. You know, there's no chain. Yep. One of those days, you just go as fast as you want. It's important to know that. And I love that you pointed out that that's an important point of the process.
Knowing if you're good or bad takes time to figure it out. Honestly, like, yeah. You have to think, right? You know, one of the things that I think is important for not just endurance athletes, all athletes, is pay attention to how things feel. It's more energy to pay attention. Not only from a standpoint of how intervals feel, but how about when you eat something? How does that make you feel? Like, do the work, pay attention, write it down, talk to your coach about it, and you will cut the learning curve. So it's really about being in the moment when you're training, when you're eating, in life in general, and distilling things down and getting tighter and tighter and tighter to understand how things affect you. You just can't listen to the coach and do the work and listen to the coach and do the work. That's not going to get you there. It's just not. Like, you'll get there, but a guy who's paying attention will get there significantly faster because he's aware of everything that's going on and how things are affecting them. And doing blind intervals forces you to be aware.
Yeah.
So that's why I recommend them. But yes, onto your thing. Testing is the next thing, right? Because maybe, Doc, now after our test, your VO2 max is way out here. You haven't done any threshold work. It's kind of lagging behind. And we got to kind of push that a little closer, right? We got to spend some time at that maximum lactate steady state, at that point at which blood lactate is going in at the exact same rate at its maximum, that you're utilizing that as a fuel source. And spending time there, regardless of anything else that you've read out there, is an important intensity to ride at, because it allows you to spend a higher output and still be at that lactic threshold, right? Spending time at that lactic threshold does less cost than being at your FTP with a very similar benefit. You can get a lot more work there, and we can monitor it. It's a point in time that we can measure, unlike FTP, which is a combination of a lot of different energy systems, which at the end of the day changes based on a lot of different things. So
day to day, even. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So that lactic threshold, or that maximum lactate status state, or anaerobic threshold, or whatever people call it, LT2, I don't even know. We just say it's the point at which the most blood lactate's going in, the most blood lactate that you're utilizing without it rising, right? Mm-hmm. And you're doing the most potential work at that intensity. So I think eventually getting some time there, because that's not only important from a standpoint of building your fitness, it's also very specific to a lot of the climbs at SBT. So it's not only work that's great for the energy system, but it's also work that we're going to use during the race itself. We're going to spend a little time there. So we may move and evolve the training to there if the testing results show that, but ultimately we probably do it anyways because it's specific to the event.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing about that metric, that point at which all this stuff happens, call it threshold. It is probably, I would even take away the probably, the one thing in your physiology that is most determinant with respect to your performance as an endurance athlete. So if there's one thing you can improve, it is that point in time, that point in your physiology, and you will improve how you're going on the bike. So there's so many reasons to move that forward. I totally agree with what you're saying there. So we've kind of been tweaking duration, intensity, frequency, retest, get to the kind of warmer months. And along with that, I, like most people, probably have a little more time to train too. So it opens up some, an increase in the duration, increase in volume that I'm able to do as I get toward the event. Is there anything, one of the dark arts of coaching is peaking, right? And how to get somebody at the greatest point of their fitness, really fit, and then recovered for the event so that they maintain as much of that fitness as possible, but come in fresh. Do you have any insight for somebody who maybe, maybe me looking for a steamboat again? Like, how far am I going to go into this? When do I shut it down? How do I come into the race fresh and fit?
You know, I always err on the side of, I think about it like picking stocks, right? Or like selling a stock. Don't try to sell your stock at the absolute peak, right? Like, if you've got some good gains and you've made some good money, take your gains off the table. And if some guy next to you says, oh, you did it 2 weeks early, I got another $2. So what, right? What you don't want to do is that thing crashes down and all of a sudden it's tumbling and you're trying to sell it and you can't. Like, that is a bad place to be.
Yeah.
So, and I think ultimately part of the thing is what I talked about earlier, right? Don't make the goal everything. Make the goal a celebration. And depending on how important this event is to you, you got to take a little bit more or less risk, right? With athletes that the journey is their goal and they're just doing this event because they want to have some fun, you want to really be make sure that they're not bad there, right? Or they're overdone. That's, you definitely don't want to do that. But if a guy needs every ounce because he wants to qualify for world championships and he has to like be perfect and he's like me where he needs everything to go right or he doesn't have a chance, you may have to risk not being great, right? So again, it comes back to the motivation I talked about earlier, Doc. Like for you, I'm going to be real cautious. I'm not going to get crazy, right? And I'm going to say all the increase in intensity, at least to start, is going to come on the aerobic side because you have more time. I don't want to risk cooking you at all. So even if you have an extra 3 hours, we're going to do all zone two just because we want to be safe as we bring you up to 12 hours, up from 8 hours to 12 hours. So we're going to start with just that. Once you've established that that's okay, we may throw in more threshold now. Instead of 60 minutes a week, we may push you to 80. We may even push you to 100 and see a crack a little bit, which is okay. Sure. Understand, cracking is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because we know where not to go next time. So ultimately, we got to kind of find where you crack a little bit. And I like to find it on threshold-based work and just keep adding more and more and more until they kind of fold up a little bit, but not bad, right? We're going to see it right away. It's comments. I'm keeping track. Everything is good. And you're learning as well, Doc. Ooh, that was a little bit too much, RV. I don't think I can handle 160 minutes. Okay, let's take a rest week. We know this is kind of where you landed in terms of your height. Now what we want to do is land there again, maybe even a little higher a few weeks before the event. Then we start reducing intensity. We start reducing volume. We want to keep the height of the intensity. We want to keep the duration of the amount of intense days you're doing. But we just, instead of doing 120 minutes, we're doing 60, right? You can tolerate 60 for sure. And we want to keep the frequency of the zone too, but we may pull back the duration as well as that. And that should bring you up to a nice cam. And then a couple of days before we do some efforts, we have something specific that we have planned. Like I always create a Steamboat specific workout and we'll do that. Even the week of, we'll just cut everything down in terms of like, instead of doing 3x10, we might do 1x10 and then a 3 minute and a 2 minute, because we do those as well as part of the specificity of the event. And you should be pretty darn good. I'm not going to screw you up if I do that. I guarantee it, you're going to be good. You might not be perfect. I might have been able to stretch you another week of build, but I'm not doing that with you, Doc. You got a lot of other things on your plate. The last thing I need is you to cave in a week before the event, mentally and physically. So I'm just not going to push it.
Well, and it's also respecting the goal that I set out, which was, like we said, not to win the thing, is to complete it, feel like I'd put in a good effort and enjoy it, you know, not be cracked. I mean, it's going to be hard, right? But not just be hating every minute of the last half of the race. And so I think that those are really sage words of advice, especially for people who are being, you know, maybe self-coaching or for new coaches, to just understand that there's a lot more risk in overcooking it than there is in coming in a little too fresh. And I think, I mean, honestly, even at a pro level, I would much rather my athletes come in just slightly fresh. Because you can shake off those cobwebs pretty quick. And if you need a little bit of resilience one way or the other, if you're overcooked, there's not much you can grab onto. If you're a little fresh and maybe, you know, not quite as sharp as you could be, that extra freshness you can use to kind of push yourself a bit further. And, it's going to go better in the long run, I think.
Yeah. The big target to me, the big focus when you get to this point is executing on the race day and really helping them design a race plan, get their focus away from, oh, I'm not training as much, I'm losing fitness, and more on, you can be the fittest ever and do everything right and completely lay an egg if you really don't have a plan of attack and the understanding of your nutrition on race day, your pacing on race day, and what to do when things start to get a little bit dark. Understand and give people some swing thoughts, help them through some of the challenging things, explain to them kind of what's going to happen. So to me, I spend a lot of time with race plans and I spend a lot of time getting people's heads right around execution and not expectation. It's the whole thing in the beginning, right? Make the goal about having a celebrating the day and managing the day the best they can, rather than, oh my gosh, if I don't do this, I'm going to fit. Like you got to really give them the tools to execute. And I think that's what I do best, is I really give people a lot of confidence, but I also let them know that if stuff starts to go sideways, here's what I want you to think about. Forget about the end, Think about your nutrition, think about your cadence, think about your pacing, your breathing, the stuff that really helps you get through things rather than you're focusing on that end game.
You know, my next question for you was going to be about the benefits of hiring a coach versus being self-coached. And I think you just answered that, quite honestly. There's lots of differences in the two, and certainly, you know, somebody may be coming to their first event and financially can't afford to hire a coach, and there's reasons to do both. But I've always been biased with my patients who come to me with this type of goal to say, hey, you would do really well to get a coach, to have an objective outside view of this, to walk you through when you need to pull back, when you need to push harder. You know, not just sticking to a table that you found in a magazine somewhere that says you need to do this, this, and this. But what you just laid out there, being able to prepare them for the event beyond just the physiological components, but the psychological components, the competitive preparatory aspects of nutrition and strategy and those things, that pays huge dividends. And I think right there, if you find a coach that does that well, and not all coaches do that well, I think unfortunately it's more often the case that coaches don't do that well. But when you find the one who does it well, that's just worth its weight in gold with respect to you reaching your goal of whatever, even my goal of just finishing and feeling good. That's going to be hugely important, because those dark moments are going to come on a 140 mile race. They're going to come in a marathon. They're going to come in a half marathon. I mean, there are times where the pain hits and you've got to know what you're going to do to get through it, because you can get through it if you've got a plan, but if not, it can sink the whole ship and all the months you've spent putting into it.
And there's nuance, right? There's nuance to all of our sports. There's nuance to doing intervals. Like if you pick a plan from the internet, for example, and it says, go out and do 4x7 minute efforts and do them at 85% of your threshold. Most people will do that wrong. Like, I mean, they're just workout execution. How do you do a really good workout? How do you add skill development to a workout? How do you create more than just the power output? I mean, people focus, when you're self-coached, you focus on one thing mostly, and that's power output. That's really what you're looking at, right? You're trying to grow your power output for these given durations. And power output is a small portion of a successful event. There is so much more than power output that goes into a good bike rider or a good marathon runner or a good anybody, right? I mean, there's pacing strategies. There is how you handle your bicycle. There is the draft. There's a pack component. There's tactic. There's, understanding terrain management. There's just so many elements, aerodynamics, bike fit. There's nutrition. There's just so many pieces that power output does not cover down on. And to me, you need a coach to help cut that learning curve. You don't need a coach, but you'll stumble around and figure things out on your own and bounce into different things, and you'll eventually get there. But a coach will get you there significantly faster with less injuries and optimizing significantly faster. And hopefully, and this is my hope, making it more fun. Making it more relationship-based, like having someone there that's in the journey with you. I don't know if you've ever done something on your own or done it with a group. For me, and this is just me, and some people are different, being with a group is so much more fun. It's easier. It keeps me more motivated. When I have my coach, or I have my coach's athletes, or I have other people to share the experience with, boy, is that a heck of a lot more fun than just following some plan that on the internet that is going to get me, quote unquote, there from a physical perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you. And definitely there are people who like to train alone. There's days where I like to train alone. But I think all things being equal, what you just explained, I'm totally on board with. And I think you just answered my next question, which the last place I wanted to go was to talk about AI and coaching. And you didn't, I mean, We can go deeper on this, but I think all those human elements you just touched on are obviously the con side of AI. You can't have, and the reason I bring this up for those who aren't maybe familiar is a lot of companies are starting to implement AI algorithms to provide coaching insight, whether that's preparing a program, giving you feedback, even designing the workouts or tweaking them intra workout, like to change what you need to do. And there's some good there, I think, that we can talk about too. But the part that you're absolutely missing is everything you just detailed, which is not to be overlooked, in my opinion. But I'll throw it out there. What's your opinion? I know you just sat on a panel at a big endurance conference talking about this. So I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts on AI and coaching.
Yeah, I think AI is part of coaching. It should be part of your coaching process, right? It should be part of, I mean, there's just so much information out there. I mean, when you think about relative AI, and that's kind of where we're at right now, we're not quite to this where it can like take over and map how your brain thinks. I mean, it can pick what Netflix shows I like, which is pretty impressive. But at the end of the day, relative AI is really focused on the inputs you give it, right? And as an athlete, I don't know what those inputs are. I don't know what I should put into this algorithm to figure out how to prepare for something. That's what the coach really has a better idea of, right? The inputs that need to go in to figure out things. Like, for example, I use Best Bike Split. It's an AI-based program. You put in all this great information, and it tells you how to pace your Ironman. So there are really cool things that have that AI is really good at. And figuring out how hard you should go for an Ironman is one of the things it can do, but only if you have all the data. You know they're 50-50 fat and carbohydrate. You know they're 400-calorie carbohydrate burn. You know their combustion rates. You put all that information in, then you get a really good product out. And that's even like an Oura Ring or Oura Data or Inside or like the algorithm that I use for Sebastian for metabolic testing. Like, you still have to do everything right and put the inputs in perfectly to get usable information out. And then you got to take that usable information and find a way to optimize it with your athlete and all the things that they have going on. So I believe it's great. Heck, I use it for a lot of my emails, and I'm sure you guys do as well, right? There's really cool things that we can embrace as coaches, but there's just not enough. The athlete doesn't have enough information to build something on their own. A coach doesn't have enough information, right? They have to constantly be talking to the athlete and figuring things out. And so I think there's elements of it that I love, but ultimately the human element is so important in a coaching relationship. It's so important, not only from a coach to the athlete, but getting that athlete to feel like he's part of something bigger than just the coach in him, right? Bringing in other people into the fold. So I think it takes a village to do things right. You have to have, there's so many elements as part of the big circle of to taking care of an athlete that AI is, although there's elements to it, it just falls short on the human part of it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, it's a tool, and you need a toolbox, not one tool. And it can play a great role. It's only as good as its inputs. But as we refine those and refine the data that goes into it, then it will get better and better at making suggestions. But I think maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I think it will never replace the human element. And probably the ideal balance there will shift a bit, but the good coach who has that human component and can utilize the massive data available to help really hone a program and individualize it is going to be the successful coach. And you can't, in my opinion, just have an AI algorithm, program, whatever, that is instructing your training, because many of them are based on population numbers, right? It's a big data set because it comes from a lot of people, and it's going to tell you what's going to be most effective for that population. But until you get a whole lot of data individually in there, it's going to have a much harder time saying what's best for you. It may get there eventually, but just like you were saying with someone who coaches themselves, they'll get there eventually too, but it's going to take lots and lots of time and mistakes and data and paying attention. And it's much better to have someone who can see the subjective side of that, I think, and help that process go more smoothly and quicker. And that's where a combination of coach and AI or coach and data in general is, in my opinion, going to be more successful, streamlined, and more enjoyable.
Yep. I'm with you. I agree.
Well, RV, I really appreciate you having this conversation with me. Thanks for hopping on. And I'm actually going to see you tonight. We are we are states away at the moment. We're going to have dinner tonight up in the mountains here in Tennessee. So I'm going to let you go so you can get on the plane.
Hold on. I want to see you on my Velocity platform at some point, Doc. I mean, I think, you know, I talked a lot about, you know, teaching people things. I talked a lot about that human connection. I talked a lot about connecting people together. And I agree with you. On my long, easy rides, on my athletes' long, easy rides, I want them to go out there and do them by themselves so they can ride right at the intensity that's optimal. They can kind of get away. But if you want to really have fun and learn and do all the things that we talked about are super important in terms of that interaction and that human element, you know, we you know, this velocity, this ability to, and all these coaches can use it, the ability to, no matter where your athlete is, to see them. Because seeing people to me, like seeing you right now in this podcast is so much better than if we were doing it over the phone. I mean,
totally.
No matter what, I can see your facial expressions. We can connect significantly more when you can actually see your athlete. And you understand how just my energy, a coach's energy, motivation, correcting in the moment how to do things, like managing and teaching people how to shift properly and keep cadence consistent. All those things are really hard to teach through an email. So being able to see an athlete and being able to motivate them in the moment where they're actually doing an exercise or an interval and watching them do that and getting them through that at their maximum, I think is going to be the future. That's how you're going to keep up and stay ahead of the group when you're coaching athletes, is that human connection and teaching them all that's in your head. I mean, I have a lot of stuff in here that needs to come out. And I can't do it for every single athlete, but boy, if they take my class, they're going to get a lot of that knowledge on a consistent basis. So hopefully I can get it to you someday.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic point. And for those who aren't familiar, Velocity that you're referencing is a platform that allows coaches to coach groups of people in that way, where they have visualization of them. They see all the data, the athletes themselves see the data, they see the coach. And when I say see the data, we won't get all into it here, but if anybody's interested, definitely go to the website and look. It is a really unique and accurate and motivational way to walk someone through what they need to be doing. So if you're prescribing targets of, you know, whether that's power or cadence or whatever it is you're trying to get them to do, they have a very clear dial basically on the screen that as they work on their trainer, they can, you know, hit their target or be off. And when they're off, they know how to bring it back down. So it's a fantastic teaching tool. I highly recommend taking a look, because it is something that all the stuff that we've talked about for the last hour, it's a great tool that coaches can use to implement these things with their clients virtually and in a group setting, which is just, it's gold, really. I mean, it's,
you can do one-on-one. You can do one-on-one classes as well. It doesn't have to be with a group, the nice thing is you can make it fun. I mean, training's hard enough. Having a little bit of fun, a little bit of competitiveness, you know, being able to connect during the class. It's just cycling, biking, and endurance sports is very, very difficult. You need to enjoy it. You need to have fun. You need to constantly be learning. And I would find tools out there as coaches and athletes that make this process a lot more fun, a lot more engaging, but where you're always learning something new. So hopefully if your coach doesn't have Velocity, they can absolutely get it. It's available out there for any coach that wants to use it. I think it's pretty cool. And Doc, you know, I know you're going to close this out, but I just want to say thank you for having me on. Really, really appreciate your time. You always give me your time, which I know is super valuable, and I can't thank you enough for it. So I appreciate it. Hopefully I brought some interesting information to the group today.
Oh, absolutely. And I certainly learned from it. I know others did. I love that you were on here. Always enjoy talking to you. I did not get signed up for Steamboat Gravel this year. That has passed, but let's see if we can find something and meet late this summer and do a big ride somewhere.
Love it. Thanks, Doc.
All right, RV, go get ready for dinner. I will see you shortly, a couple states away. Thanks for listening to The Podium. To hear more, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram, where I am at Dr. Kevin Sprouse. That's at Dr. Kevin Sprouse. The podcast posts at the_podium_podcast. You can also find and follow me on Strava.
The content of this podcast is meant for general informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. All listeners should speak with their doctor or medical practitioner before implementing any change in their healthcare regimen. If you're currently a patient at Podium, then you have an established doctor-patient relationship with me, and I'm happy to discuss this with you. If you're not currently a patient at Podium, nothing in this recording establishes a doctor-patient relationship between us, nor does it constitute the practice of medicine, nor the dissemination of medical advice. Should you implement any information contained herein without consulting your own physician, you do so at your own risk. The Podium Podcast is a Palm Tree Podco production. Our executive producer is Anthony Palmer, and the associate producer is Garrett Wright. Thanks to our digital team, Emily Miles and Caitlin Krings. The content for this episode was created by the team at The Podium.